Hi, how are you? The Bicycle Institute. So I thought, who are we? We're advocates, and we're advocating for utility cycling. So really that cycling that we've been talking about wanting to plan for, rather than sports or recreational cycling. We're volunteers, which means we have independence and the ability to tell people we think they're doing wrong because we're not dependent on funding. And we're cyclists, and so I would say if anyone has a project, come to us, talk to us, we'll do our best to engage and to provide advice. Innovation. Approach to innovation is a three-step, very simple process, and yes, I am being very tongue-in-cheek, but basically think, understand, and then document it, please. Our advice: use evidence, not ideology. Look at examples. Be a cyclist or consult with cyclists. You need that cyclist vision. And plan to fail. When you're innovating, you're trying new things. And you're not going to get them right first time. Things are going to come up. Make sure that you've done the research and everything. But consult, communicate, tell people what's going, prototype, review, amend. That's going to be something that you will need to do in all probability. If you don't, fantastic, you've hit the jackpot. But when you amend, you really are going to need to re-communicate all of that. What's your fallback position if everything goes pear-shaped? Where's your political management? Are your councillors or your minister going to immediately keel over if they get any negative feedback? You've really got to think about those things. And I would say, if you're new to the field, do pick up a copy of Ostrode's Part 14. Read it cover to cover. You're not going to use it, but it's going to give you some basic principles. And when you innovate, you are probably going to be doing things from first principles because you're not going to find the design advice that you really, really want, as we've heard. And so you need to understand where it's coming from. All of the design advice is based on you knowing your first principles. So, separated bike paths, we've heard a lot about them. What is the evidence? They're viewed positively. They increase safety between intersections. They reduce safety at intersections. Overall, they reduce safety. So should we stop building them? No. You've got to look at the safety of a piece of infrastructure versus the entire network safety that you are developing using these. And as we've heard, transport is only one thing. I think in Denmark and Holland and things, they actually talk about three types of safety. There's the road safety, subjective safety, and society safety. And you don't just look at transport as transport. It's part of society. So there's a good reason still to be building them. But what that does tell you is you really have to do things well if you want to maximise your safety. How do we maximise our safety? Continuous footpaths, which is something that BISA advocated very strongly for Frome, and we do in general. Please build them everywhere. They will increase your cyclist crashes by 81%. On the other hand, if you don't put them in, you're going to increase your cyclist crashes by 343%. Now, some of this increase in crashes, if you actually talk to the authors of the Danish authors of the paper, they can't tell how much of that is actually offset by a transfer from other streets. So they did control for cyclist exposure, but not necessarily a transfer from streets. So it may not be quite as bad as it looks. Just thought I'd mention that. Other research is that it will reduce your pedestrian crashes by 50%. And this is a good thing. So overall, we say build them. By the way, if you do want to know anything about that 2 metre, the curb height, etc., you won't find comprehensive analysis of that anywhere except on the BISA website where we put a discussion paper. Just thought I'd mention it. Okay, so continuous footpaths, Ostrode's Guide to Road Design, blah, blah, blah. What is it? Sounds like a footpath to me. Australian road rules. A footpath is a road-related area. Drivers crossing a road-related area must give way to both pedestrians and vehicles. And this is the basic way they work. So here's what used to be the Adelaide City Council's standard. I will point out that this was under a slightly different idea and interpretation of road rules, that is not a continuous footpath. I've seen someone almost get hit at this particular location because to the driver, that's a road, to the pedestrian, that's a footpath, and if they do have an interaction, shall we say, it's going to be the police who sort it out. Don't do it. Here's a good continuous footpath. Unfortunately, the contrast's a bit iffy, but bingo. And it also is in Adelaide City Council, so not all sort of negative here towards Adelaide City Council. Okay, if you look in your Austroads guide, it actually refers you to New South Wales RMS technical guidance. Read it. This is what it looks like. They've almost got it right. I would argue that to maintain your continuous accessible path of travel alongside the property line, those bollards should be shifted by a hair's breadth. And this is what they look like in Europe, more or less. Here's one looking back the other way, and in that case you can see it's the only way to exit a one-way street. What about signalised intersections? If you've seen this diagram, that's the way to do it. This is the Dutch signalised intersection. They actually don't use them very much in Denmark, and if they did, it might actually improve some of those crash risks. There is a YouTube site that will tell you how these work, but I actually found the best way was to sit down and look at one of our crappy roads, like this, to understand it. So the problem is the yellow track is what a cyclist would use to get around the corner, or what the driver used to use when they were going around the corner. And you've got your standard radius on your corner. You'll notice the green is the cyclist now going straight ahead from, in this case, a bike lane. And the motorist is now, because you've put a bike lane in, they're now turning from further to the right. That means that their radius is not as sharp. So they can do that turn a lot faster. Not only that, but depending on who decides who should give way, they're certainly having to look sort of behind themselves to see whether they're going to have to yield, and the cyclist is probably in the same situation. So it's kind of not good. Now, that would be the same if it was a separated path. If you actually have any sort of buffers or anything, for example, if you were able to take out a car lane, you're going to make that situation worse. The bigger that area is the more relaxed your radius is, the faster those people are going around that corner. And this is a real driver. It also happens at the side street locations. It's a driver of crashes there as well. So how does this lovely green thing that I just showed you work? If you imagine our crappy little corner, we have an intersection. It normally has a standard radius, say 6 metres, someone will correct me. If you imagine a bike lane going around the edge of that, 1.5 metre bike lane, then that gives you the red radius. What you want to do is reinstate your existing radius. And if you do that, you'll notice there's a gap between a 6 metre and a 7.5 metre radius. Fill it with concrete. Of course, that means that your cyclists are having a hard time going straight ahead. Cut it off and put a crossing. In point of fact, in this one, you're actually cutting into the pedestrian area. So it might be nice to just give the entire pedestrian crossing to the cyclist and build a new pedestrian crossing that gives them back a decent amount of space, etc., etc. Do that on four corners, colour it green, you've got the Dutch intersection treatment. And as you can see, you can fit this in even our very non-Dutch streets. We also think, diagram's gone, but we also think that there's some opportunity to look at innovation in drainage. So for Frome Street, we do like the stepped arrangement, but if you imagine that the old curb in Frome had a side entry pit, when you put a path across the front of it, you are reducing the drainage there. But a side entry pit goes a long way down. So could we perhaps rebuild it? Could we perhaps put a new side entry pit at the side of the separated bikeway to re-establish that depth of entry, which is, you know, a bit of a capacity thing there? You'd have to cut back the curb to direct water flow in. You'd have to then ramp down from the road surface, which would actually be at a higher point at that point, and then you'd connect it back to your original pit. Is it feasible? I'm sure there are some people here who can tell me not, but we need to address drainage. Now, this isn't going to fix all of the situations you've heard where the drainage is not already adequate. That is a whole new can of worms, I guess. So, yeah. Now, we talked about contraflow. Here's an example from possibly Germany, I think. And we're talking one-way bicycles accepted. Okay, the evidence. Germany reduces crashes with pedestrians because people aren't trying to go down there illegally. Cyclists transfer from main roads to safer streets. And this is, again, a difference between infrastructure and network. Belgium. Actually, contraflow is probably safer than cycling with flow, although they couldn't prove it because they didn't have enough contraflow crashes. So they're safe. It's great. It's wonderful. What about putting that treatment at the junction? It's not always easy to do that. You don't have the budget. You don't have the space. The UK required those junction treatments, so they reviewed it in 2010. Junctions aren't a problem. Waiting until you have that time and money just stops you doing something useful. The evidence is also pretty categoric that councils will still perceive a risk, and that risk may actually just be that other people try and sue them. So the best way to implement this is get your authority, in this case DIPTI, hello DIPTI, to mandate it, and then the councils feel, okay, I'm protected, off I go. It's not just for built-up areas. You'd see the obvious ability to do this in Adelaide City Council, in Unley, in those sorts of areas. This is actually, I cycle home occasionally with my grandkids from Stirling East Primary School to Norwood, as you do. I can either go down Piccadilly Road, go through a highway entry, up a contested space, past parking, through a roundabout, quite busy one, cross a highway exit, and then get onto the bikeway. Or I can go down Cox Creek Road, go down a little bit of a bit of dirt, really, embankment, cross at a pedestrian refuge, and go my merry way. The problem, again, is that Adelaide Hills Council is not going to put little bicycle accepted signs as a priority, and that's that problem, that we've actually got a great opportunity to do something cheap and really good for the network, and we're not going to because it's actually too cheap, ridiculously, strangely. Okay, I like contraflow. What do I think of this? The words missed opportunity spring to mind. This is Hindley Street. It's a not agreed proposal to make it one way with contraflow. It doesn't actually address all the problems. So the pedestrians, drunk pedestrians at night get into fights. The vegetation corrals those pedestrians onto a footpath. So the added footpath width is not going to fix things. We have local servicing, but there's nowhere for loading zones, for parking to service that local servicing. Even though it's local access, the cars are only going in one way. They can't go in the opposite direction. And it looks like a street. Even if you're a cyclist and you decide to stop and visit a business, there's this landscaping in the way. So it's actually going to make it quite difficult for you. So it's not really ideal. What do they do? What's the international best practice? Basically this. Just make it slow. Recognise that it's a local access function. And the pedestrians will naturally claim their own space. Here's another one that is a roadway. There's even a curb in this particular case, a very small curb, but there you go. This one, you can actually see that problem with servicing. Here we have someone in a wheelchair who is able to stop, park near their medical appointment and actually be taken to that without having to go up the street to a designated pedestrian crossing. This is a pedestrian space. The way that the cars go is they go up that street. So if you look very far into the distance, there's a little bit of a sign and a whole lot of pedestrians. That's because that's the road. But Eurocentric, unfortunately, this is a little bit early, so there aren't very many people around. But this is Auckland, and you'll notice the Wilson car park. Okay, let's think about what we can do if we do think about space a bit differently. This is a 2x1, Swedish 2x1 road. We use them for overtaking in Australia. Let's apply it to Grenfell Street, the buses particularly. Why do we have four lanes for buses? It's so they can pass each other. You don't actually need four lanes. You only need three. If you do that, you liberate an entire width. You can put in a bus stop, a nice bus stop in a median location. Put some trees on the median. Trees, we love trees. In this case, I've shown cars on the northern side of the street, but you could actually, of course, put that shared space concept on there. They will still have access to the car parking, they can still service buildings, etc., etc. But you can make that into a shared space and the cyclists can go through there. And this basic template can be delivered East Terrace to West Terrace. You've met all your goals and you've made the place a really nice place. Now, one of the benefits is actually faster bus loading because you can have a pre-validation, pre-loader and a pedestrian ramp up there so that you can load from both doors of your buses. So those buses actually work better too. The other thing that happens in Grenfell Street is because of the buses, you get all these funny bitumen waves, corrugations. You could make that entire section concrete. Fabulous, we get a pro there. The problem is you're trenching across there when you do have services that need doing. You could actually just put wheel tracks. We know where the buses are. Why not? And then, you know, you could brick pave the rest of it and make it into a real red space if you felt like it. Might sound pie in the sky. This one's in Groningen. Unfortunately, I was looking at the bikes, but this is actually what they're doing. It's a three-lane bus area. Roundabouts, a particular foible of mine, or a specialty perhaps. They're good for cars, but somewhere between very and very, very bad for bikes. Bike lanes, even worse. Single lane, radial safer than tangential. What's a radial? This is a tangential. This is standard Australian practice, and in fact, this roundabout is at Beulah Road on Sydenham. The thing about the tangential design is that it prioritises cars to maintain speed, and that's not necessarily a brilliant thing to do. This isn't a European one. This is the same roundabout, and it's been redesigned on a radial basis, and you can sort of see perhaps that the cars, because they come in more directly, they slow down more. They prioritise safety over speed. So this is one thing, retrofit roundabouts, please, everywhere. Once you get to multi-lane or high volume, and high volume is greater than 8,000 vehicles per day, more or less, you want a bikeway around the outside. This is an example of one. Melbourne has just built a roundabout that has all the features, a lot more green in keeping with Australian paint. And in fact, they will do some different things. But you can see here that cars can actually stop, give way to both pedestrians and cyclists before they actually have to think about stopping at the roundabout. And the angles there are much better too. German design rules I would also like to reference because there's a broader thing about roundabouts and about how we decide to put them in. And their design rules minimise increases in capacity. So, if you think you're going to need a multi-lane roundabout, don't build it. Build it and build the outer lane, but have the inner lane not traversable. In the future, maybe you build it, it becomes multi-lane. But really, why build that capacity in now when it just causes problems? Do you need a multi-lane? If it's because of your left turners, or if you can get it to function better by taking left turners out, then put in a bypass lane. That's basically a slip lane with a high entry angle. Cyclists can then, and pedestrians can cross the bypass lane as one thing, and then they're dealing with a single lane roundabout. If you have a multi-lane roundabout, this will be contentious, ban bikes. Why? Because you've got a circulating roadway, because the only way you would possibly put in a multi-lane roundabout is if you've got a circulating roadway. And being a sensible group of traffic engineers, you will not build a multi-lane roundabout where pedestrians and cyclists must cross. This isn't just German, Swedish, and a few others. They will differentiate between locations where people are and rural locations where it's really just mainly traffic. And you will not build the wrong type of roundabout in the wrong type of place. What about flush and mini roundabouts? They are used quite a lot in Germany and generally a hell of a lot of places, actually. And I can't say that there's a huge amount of design consistency per se, but they're used to highlight junctions and in low-speed environments. This one's actually at the is on a plateau, and it's probably partly because those two roads that you can see are actually high-speed rural roads that are coming in, and this is a threshold. They're slowing them down as they enter the village. Do they need to do that with a roundabout? I don't know, but it really highlights it, and certainly the junction. And the thing there is all of those different things. One of the contexts about innovation is that they can do a lot of things because of their focus on local streets being for local access. So this is a bike lane. It's a bulk standard bike lane to all intents and purposes. But notice it's got some slowing treatment, etc. The reason is because those cars are going to be parked for a long period. They're not going to cause problems, etc. And it's because it's a local street and people accept that it's a local street for local access. They have some instruments we don't have. Typically, a play street, or in UK terminology, a home zone. These aren't necessarily identical to the Dutch Woonerven, and the speed is actually higher than our shared space, shared zone requirements. Also, they don't really require curvilinear design. But again, it's all about controlling controlling vehicle access. Vehicles are allowed in there. They can get in there, they can do anything they need to, they can park there, but they have to do it at a human standard. This one, yeah, there's a bike street there, which is another device. You've got more home zone stuff and so many bits of regulation there. It's actually kind of hard to figure out what's going on, but you kind of don't need to. You can see what sort of street it is, and it's got a lovely tree in the middle because that's lovely. And when you're doing this, you know, maybe you do need to advise people it's going to be a 20-kilometre-an-hour zone. That's okay. It's about local access. This is not a through route. Or if it is, it's a through route at the standards of the local street, the local people. There's another one. There's another one. Doesn't have to be 20. This one's 30. And as you can see, there are no bike lanes because who needs them when it's 30 kilometres an hour? This is actually the typical Dutch design where they even say, do we really need two lanes for traffic? Those are bike lanes. Parking is regulated by bollards. There is off-street parking, as you can see with that van up the end. But it's all possible because they're local streets and we've got the buy-in. The community expects that, accepts that. This is actually Sydenham Road in Norwood. The scrubbed out line is the old bicycle advisory treatment. It was scrubbed out because it positions cars bikes too close to car doors, and you can tell that by possibly that hint of a logo which is to the left of the scrubbed out area. They've now put in a sharrow marking, and can I just make a plug for thermoplastic, because this sharrow is less than 6 months old. The thing is, does that really highlight this as being a safe road for cyclists? Does that make people feel like it's a cycling street? This is what they would do overseas. Can we achieve that? Now, we've heard about Western Australia and they're doing it with their safe active streets. They're doing all sorts of really interesting things about the types of traffic calming. They're making bespoke traffic calming. They're taking out parking on one side of the road and sticking it on the other. They don't have so many problems with us. They acknowledge that because of drainage. They've got sandy soils, fantastic. They've also got a bitumen plant that will do churning out all of the coloured red pavement that they can possibly use. So they have a fair few fewer problems. But one of the things there is they're really only still doing bike boulevards. So they're doing individual roads. A lot of the stuff overseas is based on that network approach. It's everything moving together, pulling together and forming areas of good streets, not just for cyclists, but for everyone. How are we going to do that, and how on earth could we ever afford it, really? There are some ways. You can stick a tree in the ground. You don't have to put in, you know, curb protuberances, etc. In particular, wherever there's a junction, a side street, you're not allowed to park there. Stick a tree. I love trees. They're often, when you actually look at lengths of street, it's not, they weren't set out in even increments of car parking spaces. So sometimes you can stick a tree in between some of the car parking, put in that curb out, curb build out if you want. There are ways, you know, we don't have the brick-laying machinery they have in Holland. I don't know where they get their clay from, but they've taken, like, you know, a country's worth and stuck it in brick pavers. But maybe we can do something a bit cheap and cheery, a little bit too cheery in this case, if you ask me, but what-o. We're willing to work with some things. We like trees, even if it means sticking them in a blister island in the middle of the street. You know what? Hey, maybe we can deal with that. And Unley has certainly shown the way in terms of the amount of road closures and things that are possible. There's also perhaps some political support that's needed to give us the instruments that we need. But, and I do apologise, I'm not a graphic designer, but we really need to refocus our commentary if we want to change a street like Sydenham Road to be part of a precinct in which most of your roads are a little bit designed differently so that they just take the emphasis off cars a bit and give that to other street side elements. And really, as traffic engineers, we say that cars are transport is a derived demand. Yet we tend to plan the entire street. Our suburbs are designed around a derived demand. So what about the things that we actually care about? We care about our family, we care about our friends, we care about socialising, we care about trees with birds cheeping in them in the morning and being a pleasant place to live. And maybe we need to communicate it in that way. So for Sydenham Road, maybe it needs to be also about, we don't need all of the cars in the morning, in the evening, because we've made it safe enough for children to walk and cycle to the local school. And if we do that, maybe we can get the political will that we need to do some of the things that right at the moment seem pretty impossible. Thank you.
Thank you, Faye.